We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frame, is at the controls this morning. You know, we've been doing this show for a long time, and one of the things that we always hope that we can do is, in the mix, find some things to talk about that we have never discussed before on the program. And I think this morning we definitely have a first as we talk about, at least in part, we're going to be talking about the use of the turntable as a musical instrument. Now, I think for most people, the turntable is a device for playing records. You remember records, right? Well, during the early days of hip-hop, the turntable also became a tool for making music, as DJs used techniques, things that we'll talk about, things like scratching, to take elements from vinyl LPs and then to put that together to make something new. We'll talk a little bit about this, how the turntable became a musical instrument. At least some people would say that it became a musical instrument. And our guest is Mark Katz. He's on the music faculty at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He is a longtime violinist. He lectures frequently on music to both academic and non-academic audiences. He's the author of several books, including one that takes a look at how technology, and here I guess we're talking about the technology to record and reproduce sound, how that has actually changed music and musicians, how it's affected performance, how it's affected the way people listen to music and where they listen to it and the place of music in their lives. That book is called Capturing Sound and came out in 2004. Also, he has a book that will be coming out about this subject of the hip-hop DJ, groove music. That's coming out soon from the Oxford University Press. He's here visiting the campus to talk about this subject in a talk that's part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study. We've been fortunate enough to talk with a number of these people. They're calling it Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. So he'll be talking on the subject Mix and Scratch, The Turntable Becomes a Musical Instrument, looking particularly at the period 75 to 78, and that will be today, 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on Gregory in Urbana. These programs are always open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And as we talk here this morning on the show, questions are welcome, too. The number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me, David. I'm really happy to be on the show.
There are a lot of interesting things we could talk about, and there are a lot of things that you write about in the book Capturing Sound that I think are really interesting. And I guess maybe just one way that we could start out and talk a little bit generally was to think about the time when, if people wanted to have music, they had to make it, or somebody had to make it. And what a remarkable thing when you get from that point to the point where some kind of device, and that always sort of keeps changing, but you can have some kind of device, some kind of box sitting there in your house that can make music.
And that's, I like how you put that. It's what we have to understand today is we're so used to having recorded music everywhere. It's completely ubiquitous. We hear it everywhere on our phones, in the shower, in the car, on the street. If you go back 100 years, that was not the soundscape of the world. If you heard music, someone was making it at that moment. And it was a huge change in the history of music and the history of art to have a device that suddenly made it possible for people to hear music that wasn't being performed live, that had been performed maybe years before. Music that you could hear but not see. Remember, people had always seen the musicians they were listening to. So all of these differences between live and recorded music had a huge impact on the way people heard music, thought about music, created music. And in my book, Capturing Sound, I explore a variety of ways that that people, musicians, listeners, performers, and composers change their habits and their ways of thinking about music in response to recording. And it was such a huge change. I mean, just one quick example, people in the early days of recording were very nervous about listening to music when they couldn't see the musicians. And they would talk about trying to find some way to recuperate that visual aspect. Sometimes they would just stare at their phonographs. Sometimes they would look at pictures of musicians. Another thing that's really fascinating that I found is that people weren't used to listening to music alone. And that's one of these things that we take for granted. We all listen to music alone now, but before the age of recording, when you heard music, you were most likely listening with a group. And people would actually say that there was something very wrong about listening to music by yourself. And I found a great article that compared listening to a phonograph alone to being caught drinking whiskey alone. It was just antisocial behavior. Yeah. So it's recording is something that we take for granted now, but if we just go back 100 years, it was completely revolutionary.
Yeah. I'm sure that for musicians, this was a strange and startling. They certainly, before, when they were playing, could hear themselves play as they played, and they could sit and they can listen to other musicians play. But the idea that they could play something, it could be recorded, and then they could hear themselves play in the way that the audience hears them play, must have been very strange, maybe a little disturbing, actually.
Definitely. And that is, you really point out something very important. Of course, you can hear your music while you're playing, but it's a very different perspective. If you're hearing it essentially through your own body, especially if you're singing. When you listen to a recording of yourself, you hear it from a completely different perspective, and it sounds very different. Actually, we all know that sensation when we hear our recorded voices and say, that doesn't sound like me. And the disturbing thing is that's how other people hear you. You just don't hear yourself that way because you're hearing it through your own body. And the interesting thing about this ability to hear yourself is that it actually led people to change the way they performed music. A lot of classical musicians, when they heard their own recordings, they realized or they thought that they were much less precise than they believed they were. People would say, oh, I didn't realize that my rhythm was so sloppy and that when I played the piano, my hands weren't quite together. So they would really work hard to be more precise and to be more consistent. And that actually had a huge impact on musical performance. If you hear some of the very earliest recordings of classical music, it's much looser in terms of rhythm. Some people listening today would say that it sounds sloppy. But in fact, that was just that looseness of rhythm and timing was part of the aesthetic. And what I argue in my book is that the ability to hear yourself after you have played and have that new perspective actually had an impact on the way people performed because they started to tighten things up. They started to try to be more precise and have fewer mistakes.
And I'm sure that what happened was that critics then started to talk about musicians playing in a manner that was more cold and lacking in feeling.
That's right. And you do have critics saying that sometimes you'll even read passages that say it was perfectly played. It sounded just like a phonograph. And you have what I would call a feedback loop where people hear the recordings, they hear that it's perfect, there are no mistakes, they demand that in live performance, and then the performers try to achieve that. Of course, that's impossible to a certain degree because a lot of these recordings were spliced or were many takes were made or they were combined in various ways, and they're not like live performances. And that's one of the big points I try to make clear to people is that live performance and recordings, they may seem similar in many ways, but in fact, they're very different in some fundamental ways.
Yeah. I wondered, did that even get to a point where people would say that they actually would prefer listening to a recording rather than going to a live performance?
Yes, definitely. And you may have had this experience. I certainly have. I go to a concert and I hear people during intermission or walking out grumbling, oh, it didn't sound anything like the recording. I could have stayed home instead of listened to the CD. And And I always feel depressed when I hear that because live recordings, I mean, live performances offer something very different. It's that communal experience. It's that experience of not knowing how it's going to end. One thing I like to say is my palms never sweat when I listen to a recording. But when I'm at a live performance, sometimes I get sweaty palms because I don't know how it's going to end. So really, they offer different kinds of experience. And you're right. What happened is people started to think of the recording as the model and mm-hmm. live performance as that which aspired to recordings.
Yeah. And no matter what, you know, no matter how high level your audio equipment may be, there's really no way to reproduce the experience of experiencing the sound in a good performance space. I mean, there's something, if you go to a symphony orchestra, you can feel the music. Mm-hmm. There's an actual physical experience
That's right.
You're never going to have, even if you have a really good stereo, you're never going to have that.
That's right. And even if you do have a really good stereo, there's just fundamental differences. The fact that you're experiencing a live performance in real time, meaning that anything could happen, that you can see the musicians. And the visual aspect is very important. People think, I think for good reason, that music is just about sound. But actually, the way we understand music is very strongly influenced by the visual aspect. So if you see Itzhak Perlman, say, the violinist, if you know what his performances are like, you can read his face. You can read all the emotions crossing his face. And that has an impact on the way we hear his music. So no matter how good your equipment may be, you are not experiencing music in the same way when you're listening at home.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Mark Katz, is an associate professor of music at UNC Chapel Hill. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk on a very different topic, and we'll get into the subject, some of the subject that he's going to be talking about this afternoon on the campus. It's part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative 2009-2010, Interpreting Technoscience. We'll be talking about mixing and scratching in just a moment here. We do have a caller, however. We'd welcome people into the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Urbana, line one.
Oh,
hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Very interesting subject. I'm also interested in listening to you talk about the development of the turntable as an actual instrument itself. But I was going to ask you about when you're talking about the development of music where you could take it off away from the public display, you know, public, what do you call a presentation, and put it on a record or a CD or in a tape, and you're interiorizing it. You can take it home with you, sit and listen to it. There was an argument about in the early 19th century about when they mass marketed books. I remember reading a paper once where the guy discussed how there's a public argument about people interiorizing, just reading it alone, instead of having like the Bible read to you at a church or something like that, and how that was sort of not a good thing for women because they could actually think on their own. And I'm not sure if you've heard of that or not, but it's interesting to see also that when you can bring music to yourself, how you can sit in alone and listen to it and how your reactions are purely personal, not public. And could you comment on that?
Sure, that's a great point that you're making, and that reinforces the general point I want to make is that live performances and recordings, I don't compare them in terms of better or worse. They just offer different experiences, and what you point out is exactly right. When you are listening by yourself, you have a sense of, some people will have a sense of communion with the performers or the composers. They have a sense of, as you say, internalizing or making it your own. Where, especially if you listen on headphones, it really sounds like the music is in your head, and it seems as if the performers are playing for you. That was one of the reasons why people like Bing Crosby, Rudy Valli, and Frank Sinatra were very popular, because of their crooning. Crooning was a type of musical performance where people would sing very softly into a microphone. You couldn't do that in live performance. It wouldn't sound quite the same. But listening at home, it felt like Frank was singing to you and you alone, and you had a greater sense of connection, or you could have a greater sense of connection with the musicians than if you were 500 or 1,000 feet away from the performer in a group of thousands. So you're absolutely right. It makes it a more individual, private experience when you're listening at home alone.
One other thing, and then I'll hang up. Interesting that I read something recently in the Wall Street Journal that because the music has become sort of free, that the concert becomes very important to the, you know, the concerts become more important to the performers to make money versus the opposite. Before, you know, you had mass, you could steal music off the web. People made money on selling records or CDs. And also, do you think that this, the interiorizing music by headphones and the lack of public participation is actually changing your brain? Thank you very much.
That's two interesting thoughts there. One, I think you're absolutely right. Recordings are not becoming the economic engine for the music industry. It has to be something else because people can get recordings free or they can listen free on YouTube and so on. And in fact, that's the way it was in the very beginning. When recordings first started coming out, they were essentially advertisements for live performances. So we're really coming full circle. The question about the brain is a good one. I don't feel qualified to answer that because I'm not a neuroscientist, but I have to think that that our change in listening habits does have an impact on our the way our brains work. I'd have to think that's true. I just couldn't tell you how that's true.
Hmm. Well, we have another caller in Champaign County here where we are, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I thought I'd wait, and I haven't in a couple of days, but when you were talking about, you know, the reaction to recorded music, it reminded me of that adolescent novelist Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf, because there's a section where his protagonist pontificates about it, and it's part of his alienation from the modern world, is talking about how bad it is to listen to Renaissance instruments played over a Victrola or a radio or something. So I just it must have stuck with me because I'm still remembering it after all these years. But I wondered also if you could, did you go into like the origin of the actual practice and clubs and how it really came out? It was really, unless I'm misled, it's sort of identified as an Afro-American innovation in dance clubs, and that, you know, whereas avant-gardists, Fred Frith comes to mind, people who take all sorts of funny things and make music with them in a curious way, that in some ways is immediately regarded as avant-garde, but I think the dominant cultural response to scratching was, you know, what's going on? What is this about? And how déclassé or something? Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. You're right, and this gets into the work that I'm doing now about hip-hop DJs. You could have, and people were doing experiments with phonographs much earlier. In fact, I've written in my book Capturing Sound about people like Paul Hindemith and John Cage, how they were essentially treating the phonograph as a musical instrument. It didn't really catch on, but you're absolutely right. When they did that, it was avant-garde. When African-American and Latino teenagers in the Bronx were doing it, it was noise. And so it's similar in some ways. They were both, you could consider both groups experimentalists, but the response was very different. So that's a great point.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I think what we should do here, if we want to try and get into this topic of mix and scratch, because there will be some people listening to us who have no idea what it is that we were talking about. I know that you brought along some music so that we could play some examples. Is there something that we could play so that we could then say, all right, this is what we're talking about right here?
Right. Well, let me set this up a little bit.
Sure.
What happened was in the early 70s, there were teenage DJs in the Bronx who played spun records for dance parties. And what they found is that the dancers particularly responded to a specific part in a song that they called the break. That's when all the voices and the other instruments drop out and you just have usually a drum beat. And it was just pure rhythm. And they often called it the get down part because people would get down and dance. And the DJ saw this and wanted to respond to the dancers, but the The problem was that these breaks were often just a few seconds long. And what they did is they, and this is where the turntable becomes a musical instrument, they started extracting these breaks and coming up with new techniques so as to repeat them over and over in real time and to mix them and then starting to scratch records. So the point I make in the beginning of the book that I'm working on now called Groove Music is that the break, that little percussion solo, is really at the center of hip-hop. And it all grew up around the break. And what I did is I came up with a few examples of songs that DJs would extract breaks from. And one point I like to make is that the DJs were very eclectic in their musical tastes. They would take breaks from anywhere. And I have examples from the Monkees, from the Winstons, from Aretha Franklin, from any number, even Aerosmith. And they all have really funky breaks. It's just very interesting to hear these breaks and then hear the context in which they come from. So, for example, I brought in some very short fragments. One is called Mary, Mary from the Monkees, and then another is Amen, Brother. And maybe if we listen to those two just short segments, you can hear those percussion breaks and a little bit of the surrounding music. And so when I talk about breaks, this is what I'm talking about.
Okay, well, let's do that. Okay, so that's the, if people are old enough, they will recognize, yes, that's the Monkees' song, Mary Mary.
Right, and what we heard was just in the first few seconds was the break, and only that part, before the guitars come in, before the singing starts, only that would be excerpted.
Just that introductory drum part, where all that was the drums.
Right, and you wouldn't even necessarily know that it was the Monkees. And then if you listen to the next track, Amen, Brother, this is a very famous break that's been used quite a bit. So why don't we listen to that? So it was just, I played a little bit leading up to the break, but I hope you're able to hear everything else drops out. And the get down part was just that few bars. It could be four bars, eight bars, where it was just the drums. But you realize that it's only a few seconds long. So it's very hard to dance to that to any extent. So the DJs would put two copies of the same record on two turntables and switch back and forth, and it's called looping. And one thing you have to understand is that when they're able to do this, they're able to extend the breaks. People are able to dance to those breaks, and that's where break dancing comes from.
And this is, you should not minimize what a technical feat to do this in real time would be. Now, with digital technology, there would be nothing to doing that. But here what we're talking about is, as you say, having a setup with two turntables, you have two records that's the same record. So what you would do is you'd play just that short bit off of the one record, and then you'd go over and play that short bit off of the other record. And while that was playing, you'd have to go back and get back that place on the first record to get back to that place in the song. So you would physically have to go back and forth, play one, play two is playing, go back, re-cue one, as one is playing, re-cue two. And if you're going to do that over and over, I guess you could do that as long as, you know, until you got so tired that you couldn't do it anymore.
Right, exactly. You know exactly how that works. And also, I should say, you need to, in order to be able to do that, you need a mixer, something that connects the two turntables so you can switch from one to the other. And you could think of it as juggling, really. If someone juggles four or five balls and it's done well, it just seems so perfect and seamless. But if I tried it, I would drop them all and it would look terrible. The same with juggling these records. If you did it perfectly, it would sound like it was just one record. If you close your eyes, you would just think you were listening to one record. But it's just as you were saying, it's almost this dance with your hands. backspinning a record, flipping a switch, backspinning another record while that's playing, going to the other one, back and forth, back and forth. That's the way people were able to extend these breaks so people could continue dancing. And that is really the basis for all hip-hop, because later on, people started rhyming over those breaks, and that was rap, and people would dance to those breaks. That was break dancing. So that's why I say it's all about the break, that hip-hop really originates with that extraction and manipulation of the break.
Yeah, and the people who do this, the people who are really good at it, became stars in their own right, because to do that as a performance, this was not something everybody could do, and then it became a very competitive thing where you'd actually have battles, competitions between different DJs to see who could do this the best.
Exactly. It was a very competitive atmosphere in the Bronx in the early 70s. And people like Grand Wizard Theodore, for example, he would put handcuffs on and then mix records. He would put a blindfold on and mix records. It was very competitive, and the people who could do it well were really virtuosi. They would practice hours and hours a day to be able to do this.
And this, the guy that you mentioned, this Grand Wizard Theodore, is the guy who is supposedly credited with coming up with the idea for scratching. I know I've read what the story is. Mm-hmm. You could tell the story.
Well, it's a great story. Now, one thing that you have to understand is that people had scratched records before, mostly accidentally. but it doesn't take much to scratch a record. So he wasn't the first person to come up with that sound. What he did is he recognized its musical potential, and he then introduced it into his DJ sets, and people liked the sound. And the story of how it happened is a great one. He was really just maybe 14 or 15. He was a high school student. He was making a mixtape at home so he could play in the cafeteria at his high school. The principal told him he could do that. He was practicing queuing up a record on one of his turntables when his mother pounded on the door and told him to turn that music down. What he did is, instead of letting go of the record, he had his hand on the record. He didn't want to lose his place because he was trying to find that break. So he kept his hand on the record, but instead of just holding it still, he moved it back and forth because he didn't want to burn out the motor by holding down the platter. And it just so happened that the mixer had the sound up on that turntable. Normally it would be down. But what he heard was this sound when he moved the record back and forth, and a light bulb went off, and he said, "I like this." And what he decided to do is to mix that into his DJ sets when he was DJing parties. People loved it, and that was the beginning of scratching.
Did you bring an example that would show that?
Well, what I have is one thing also is that scratching wasn't recorded because it was a way of treating records. But I have not Grand Wizard Theodore, but an early, the first recording that has scratching on it, which is by Grandmaster Flash, called The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel. And you will hear some scratching at the end of this excerpt. If we listen to about a minute and a quarter or so, what you will hear is both mixing and scratching. You will hear Grandmaster Flash going back and forth between two records, mixing some in, looping records, and then he gets a bass line and scratches over it. So this example from 1981 is a great example of both mixing and scratching. So maybe we could hear that.
All right.
You say, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Five, five, Freddy told me everybody slide. DJ spinning, I said, my. Flash is fast, flash is cool, Francois,
Sephora,
flash ain't
no
dude.
You say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Thank you.
Okay, so okay, now right at the end there, that's if you have any doubts about what scratching is, that I don't even know how to describe that noise, but what it is that physically the record is the needle's on the record, and the record is being moved physically back and forth to make that sort of percussive.
A rasping sound, right. Sometimes is how I describe it. Or sometimes I just make the sound, which is easier than trying to explain it. And one thing that you do have to understand that some people, there's a misunderstanding about how scratching works. You're not pulling the needle across the grooves, which would ruin the record. Basically, you're letting the needles in the groove, but you're just pushing the record back and forth underneath the stylus. And so what Grandmaster Flash was doing was he was scratching in rhythm to another song that was playing at the same time. And that was, to our ears today, it might sound very simple. And since then, people have developed a whole vocabulary of scratches. It's amazing. There's DJ Qbert, for example, who just released a DVD called the Scratchlopedia Breaktanica, where he demonstrates 100 different scratches.
And there are now places where if you want to learn to do this, you can go and you can take a course, and they will teach you. Whether you really have the stuff to do it, that may be another thing, but one can actually go and learn.
Yes, and actually I've done research on this. It was one of the more enjoyable research outings I've done. I took classes in New York, Miami, and Los Angeles, going to these various branches of the Scratch DJ Academy, and even spent 5 days in a DJ boot camp where all we did all day was learn how to DJ.
Yeah, so how'd you do?
I did okay. I have a diploma from the Scratch DJ Academy. I have passed the DJ 101 course, and it hangs very proudly in my office. It's something that not all of my PhD colleagues can boast about.
Our guest in this hour, Mark Katz, he is associate professor in the Department of Music at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He lectures frequently on music to both scholarly and non-academic audiences. He's a longtime violinist, beginning turntablist. He's also a DJ at UNC's radio station. He does research and teaching on music and technology, on popular music, on performance practice. One of the things that he's interested in and has written about is how recording technology changed the way musicians perform and the way people listen to music and the way people think about music. That's the subject of his book, Capturing Sound, How Technology Has Changed Music. That was published in 2004. Has a new one that will be coming out soon from Oxford University Press on the art and culture of the hip-hop DJ, groove music. And he'll be talking about this very subject, mix and scratch, about how the turntable became a musical instrument. This is as part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2009-2010, Interpreting Techno Science. And he'll talk this afternoon at 4 in Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on the campus. It's free, open to the public. Anybody who would like to stop by is welcome. Here, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. On the last cut, you played a little bit of the cut from Grandmaster Flash. Not only is he doing the scratching, not only is there some material that he has had created to go into that, but he's also taken little pieces of other recordings and combined all these things together. How did people think about the fact that what these DJs were doing was they were going out and they were getting somebody else's record, and they were taking a little piece of that and incorporating that into their piece? On one level, you'd have to say there were some kind of rights issues here about, mm-hmm. What it was they were doing and what sort of ownership there was and who owned the finished piece.
Well, it raises some really interesting questions, because what you heard on that Grandmaster Flash cut is clearly he wasn't just playing someone else's recording. He was manipulating them and transforming them. And one way to look at what he's doing is that he's taken these finished recordings that were works in themselves, and he's made them into raw materials for his own creation. And so on the one hand, you could say that, I would say, my own personal feelings, that falls under fair use, that he is not infringing by these very creative, transformative uses of these pre-existing recordings. But other people, especially copyright holders, may feel otherwise. So it's a pretty touchy subject. Lots of people feel strongly one way or the other about how these DJs are manipulating music and whether they have the right to do that.
Yeah. When, as we talked about the fact that this as a piece of live performance was so important, when people got around to start recording these things, did people think differently about them and maybe raise some questions about, well, yeah, you managed to do this in a studio, but could you really get up in front of the crowd and do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was it started out as a purely live performance practice, which is odd because they're using recordings. But then the first hip-hop recording wasn't until 1979, which was years after people had been DJing. Mm-hmm. And that led into hip-hop became more of a studio art, where DJs were no longer really manipulating in real time, but instead producers were excerpting and looping, and sometimes even live bands would play in a way to get around the rights issues. So there is a real change in hip-hop from a live performance art to a recorded one. And then you get into digital sampling, which is really just like DJing, but using digital equipment instead of analog equipment. So there is a real fundamental change in the way hip-hop was practiced over the course of its first 20 years.
Let's talk with some more folks. Starting with line number four, there's someone in Indiana. Hello.
Hello. Let me just express two things that came to my mind after listening to you talk up to this point. One was the thing, I think it happened before the Beats, but one of those fellows started cutting things up, lines of, from pages of book and things, then putting them together in different ways to get things that actually made sense phonetically. It was as I remember it. And the second thing is, I was very deep into jazz at one time, actually when I was down Chapel Hill. And I remember a jazz person being asked, I think it was somebody that played for Miles Davis, said, well, what about this rock and roll? And he says, well, one thing about it, they sure in the hell have changed sounds a lot. Mm-hmm. He didn't make anything else about their musicianship or where chords were changed or anything like that. It was all sound. So I think, that's what we're going on, isn't it, is that we're getting to the basis of, since another way of looking at sound from what the physicists have been telling us all this time. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call. I just think one point you're making that I think I'm glad you make is that there's a lot of continuities between what these DJs were doing and what other musicians, jazz musicians, or other artists, poets, painters were doing in terms of mixing, collage, and so on. So I don't want to claim that that these DJs were the only ones doing this kind of thing. But in fact, as you point out, lots of similar things were happening before and at the same time in the other arts.
Okay. Let's go to another caller. This is someone in Champaign and in line one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Mm-hmm. You played a section from Grandmaster Flash, and I tuned in and I listened to it, and it sounded identical to Queen's Another One Bites the Dust. Now, in this situation, who copied who and who played it first? Who got sued and who got the credit?
That's a great question. You're absolutely right. Grandmaster Flash played an excerpt from Queen's Another One Bites the Dust. But in fact, before that, he played an excerpt from a group called Chic, called Good Times. Good Times, the bass line for Good Times sounds almost exactly the same as Queen's Another One Bites the Dust. Chic was first. So one thing that I find interesting about this excerpt is that Flash is, in a sense, making a kind of commentary on originality. He played Good Times, which was that original bass line. Then right after that, he played Queen's Another One Bites the Dust. And he's essentially pointing out how Queen took from Sheik. And then what Grandmaster Flash is doing is taking from both of them. So it's this very interesting situation where everybody seems to be taking from one another. As far as I know, Flash wasn't sued for this, though I do believe that that there might have been some co-composer credit given to the musicians in Sheik.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And again, to line three. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to say how great it was hearing that excerpt from Grandmaster Flash. It just brought back so many memories of such great stuff during that time. One thing I wanted to ask is, were there any particular songs that tended to be used over and over for this work? And if so, were there particular things about them that they had in common that made them used so often?
That's a great question. Yes, there were. You might even think of it as a kind of canon of breaks. And they did have certain musical characteristics. In general, as I mentioned, a break is a percussion solo, but often having a very heavy downbeat combined with various syncopations. So you would have what they call an emphasis on the one, which is the first beat of either a measure or a phrase, where it can really lock in the beat so dancers could dance to it. But then it was balanced out by these syncopations in the middle of the measure to give it a little kind of off-balance feel. It almost makes you want to dance, this combination, these strong beats and these syncopations. Also, a very heavy bass was good because a lot of these, a lot of the DJs were playing outside, and you wanted to be able to hear outside, and the bass carried well, and you could almost feel it as well as hear it. So that's a great question, and you're absolutely right. There were some commonalities among these various breaks and songs that they used.
Okay. Well, other questions are welcome. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Mark Katz from the Department of Music at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Questions welcome. You talked about how this really got started, first of all, as something for people to dance to, and then it got to accompaniment for rappers. But then it seemed like what happened was that the rappers and the rap sort of eclipsed the beats that that started out to accompany them. Then do we get a point where the people, the DJs, are actually have broken away from the rappers, where they're back more having the spotlight focused just on what they're doing?
Exactly. You're exactly right in explaining that kind of history. One thing, again, that people don't quite realize is that the rappers, originally called MCs and still often called MCs, were not at the beginning of hip-hop. And in fact, the MC was, just like the name suggests, a master of ceremonies. They would announce over the microphone songs. They would introduce the DJ. They would tell people that there was a car with its lights on in the parking lot. Occasionally they would shout out some rhymes, or they would encourage the dancers to throw their hands up in the air like they just don't care, and so on. And really, they were just the sidekick to the DJ. But eventually, they started becoming more creative, and their rhymes became longer. Then, instead of just having one MC, they would have a couple of MCs, and then they would start wearing matching outfits, and then they would start choreographing steps. Suddenly, the focal point of these parties was the rappers, not the DJs. And then the big change came when people started to put this on record. And what happened was the MCs, the rappers, went to the studio and recorded, and they simply had live bands playing behind them. The DJs were left out in the cold, essentially. And what happened was DJs, they still worked with dancers and rappers, but then they started to develop their own craft, which came to be called turntablism, and essentially became instrumentalists, very virtuosic performers, and developed their own techniques and have these battles where they compete against one another. So it was a huge change, really around 78, 79, when the DJ and the MC started to go in separate ways.
Yeah, I think that the term turntablist is really interesting, because what that means is it's a laying claim to the idea of the turntable as an instrument. Apparently, somebody who was doing this, he sort of said, well, let's see, people who play the piano, we call them pianists, and I play the turntable, so I'm going to call myself a turntablist. and that stuck.
And that's exactly what happened. Sometimes people ask me, who haven't heard this term, they ask me if I made that up because it sounds like a kind of academic term. No, I didn't. This was DJs came up with this, and it was exactly what you said. The term identifies them as musicians, and they are performers of the turntable. And it also, the ism, turntable-ism, elevates it to a kind of practice or an ideology. So it's a way of asserting the instrumentality of the turntable and the musicianship of DJs.
Mm. We're coming down to the point, we have a couple of minutes left. Something I would like to return to a little bit is the point where we were talking at the beginning about technology and music and how it changes music, how technology changes music and the way people think about it. And I think about the fact that now we have these very easily portable digital devices, things that you can put in your pocket that can have days' worth of music. You could start it playing, and 3 days later it would still play, and it wouldn't have repeated anything. And most of these, I guess, are digital formats like the MP3, for example, that people know about. You can download them from iTunes or wherever. You can take your own CDs and you can convert them and you can put them on your player. And I think about how audiophiles bemoan the MP3 and formats like this. People who really are interested in the more traditional reproduction technologies, for whom lifelike sound was the thing, what they were trying to do as much as they could in their living room or their listening space, was recreate the concert hall. Mm-hmm. So faithful reproduction of sound with full fidelity, even if they knew it was in a frequency range that they couldn't even hear, that was important. And they look at the MP3 and they say, oh, it's just a shadow of what the music really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. Audiophiles are really unhappy about MP3. And it's not just the fact that MP3s are compressed, meaning data is taken out, but the way people listen to MP3 players. If you look at the iPod, those earbuds are terrible. The sound isn't very good. Also, the circumstances in which people listen to them. If you're on any campus here or at UNC or anywhere, you will see students walking across campus with those earbuds on when there's a lot of noise going on. They're exercising while listening to them. And what's happened is there's really a kind of sea change. As you mentioned, for decades, the idea had been fidelity. Now it's changing. It's all about convenience. Good sound is great if you can have it, but it's all about convenience. And I would say that we're moving into what we might call a post-fidelity age, where the ideal is not perfect sound, but absolute convenience.
Well, if you do that, and what's interesting about these technologies like the MP3, and to the extent that I understand it, is what it does is it looks at the piece of music, and in a sense it graphs it out, and it sees that there are actually places there where there isn't anything. And so the reason that you can make this file so much smaller is that they're looking at stuff that you can actually hear, and they're kind of smooshing that together, and they're cutting out the other stuff. So then the question is, well, if what you've done is you've cut out something that you can't hear, have you lost anything?
That's a really interesting question. And in fact, MP3 encoding is becoming much better, so that really, if you do tests with people, play them a high-quality MP3 and a CD, they won't be able to tell the difference anymore because it is getting better. So in the early days, the compression was extreme enough so that you could hear the difference. It would sound swishy or almost like it was underwater. But now it's gotten much better. In fact, the sound quality is at a pretty high level. You still have what I mentioned, though, that people no longer care about that. Most people don't care if it's encoded at 128 or 256 or 320. Some people do. But really what they want is to be able to carry it to the gym, to be able to listen in class when they should be listening to their professor and so on. So even if the sound does get better, we're still convenience is still king now.
And is that bad for the music?
In some ways it is, because people aren't listening carefully, because it's music has become wallpaper, sonic wallpaper, and people don't study wallpaper. And it would be like having Shakespeare on as wallpaper. You won't get quite as much out of it as if you actually read it. So there is that danger. On the other hand, it does mean that people can have music wherever they want, whenever they want, and I think that is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, we're at just about the point here we're going to have to wrap up for this hour. I do want to mention again that our guest, Mark Katz, from UNC Chapel Hill, from the Department of Music, will be giving a talk on the subject Mix and Scratch, the Turntable Becomes a Musical Instrument. And this is part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2009-2010 Interpreting Technoscience. So if you'd like to hear him this afternoon, 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium, that's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And this, like all of these events, they're always free, open to the public, and anybody who's interested in attending can do that. If you'd like to read some more on the subject of how technology has changed music, you might take a look at his book Capturing Sound from 2004. And then you can look forward to his book Groove Music, The Art and Culture of the Hip-Hop DJ. That'll be published by Oxford University Press. Do you know when that will be
As soon as I can finish it. sometime next year.
And in the meantime, you're going to continue to polish your scratching skills?
Yes, I have turntables in my office, and I do practice.
All right. How do the guys on either side of you at the... Or are you wearing headphones when you do it?
Not always. My next-door neighbor in school is not entirely thrilled about the bass shaking his walls.
Hey, thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.